Hey, Gilmore Ball Z fans, just a quick content warning for this episode. There is some discussion of suicide and suicidal tendencies, mental illness of that regard, and there is some discussion of, like, childhood cancer, childhood illness, and stuff like that. So if that's a sore subject for you, maybe hold off on this one, gauge your emotions before you listen. So thank you, and on with the show.
Hello, and welcome to Gilmore Ball Z bonus episodes. This is normally a podcast where I show my husband Gilmore Girls, he shows me Dragon Ball, and we try to find some sort of common ground. But this week, thanks to your generous donations to Room to Read and the Gohan and Rory Book Club Fund, we are watching The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, starring Alexis Bledel, Rory of Gilmore Girls. Here, as a special guest, we have Kiri. Say hi, Kiri.
Hello, beloved listeners. I am so excited to be here.
Kiri, I think Kiri counts as a super fan of the show. Mm-hmm. In case for some reason this is your first episode, I'm Grant.
And I'm Paige.
And this is our guest, Kiri. Before we even get into Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, Kiri, what is your experience with Gilmore Girls and Dragon Ball Z?
Well, with Gilmore Girls, that one goes way back because I remember I would have been like 13 or 14 when my mom was like, hey, let's watch this. And so that, it was kind of a recurring thing in my junior high years. Yeah, and we made it, I think, through season 3 before we just kind of fell off of it, but it was very much like a formative thing that I grew up with, basically, and always considered myself to have, like, loved as a tiny, even though I never actually finished it. And then, you know, years passed, whatever, my taste changed. I never actually saw the whole thing or thought about it again. And then the revival was announced.
Oh, and poor baby doll.
Yeah, that's a different subject entirely, but basically, I was like, okay, the revival is going to come out. I should watch the whole thing. Yeah, so I spent 2016 rewatching the Gilmore Girls I had seen and then watching the parts I hadn't. And I fell in love. I can't even explain it, really. I just got kind of obsessed with it. And I have a great deal of thoughts and feelings and opinions
on many subjects.
Yes, which you are, of course, well acquainted with, thus leading to my recent show nickname of all caps Kiri. But
every text.
Well, not well. Well,
90%.
Yeah.
So Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah. My experience with that is not a goddamn thing. Yeah, actually, was it on the Toonami block? Because,
yes.
Yeah, I remember seeing ads for it because I did watch some Toonami shows when that was a thing. And I recall, like, my 10-year-old perspective being just kind of like, that looks weird and not cute and not fun and it looks scary and I don't care.
So, and
about 80% of that assessment is accurate, so
So at that time, were you watching watching and reading Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants instead?
Yeah, that was another one when I was younger, I think, because the first book, I don't even remember when the first book came out, that was like 2003 or something, but
once again,
that was a quick movie deal then.
Yeah, and so I read the books, and then saw the movie, blah, 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 very important, very informative. Very formative, same whole story. And then I also kind of fell out of those for a while and reread the books in college. Those were also things that I cared about very much just because I love those four girls, you guys, so much. They're my daughters.
They're characters, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually Anne Brashears had released a follow-up book because there were four books originally. And then years and years later, she wrote
in 2011?
Yes. A new book, revisiting the girls a decade into their adult lives, because revivals are not just for Netflix anymore. And so I read that, and it was...
What? I'm sorry, I'm just reading the plot description for this book right now.
It was depressing, but ultimately hopeful. But also weirdly, unexpectedly dark, but we don't have to get into that right now, because we're here to talk about the movie!
We are here to talk about the movie. So, Yes, we watched the 2005 Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants movie. I don't even know where to start. I guess since this is technically a Gilmore Girls property, I should summarize the film.
No, here, I'll take it because I'll go quicker.
We can all help.
The thing is, it's 2 hours. I go quicker.
Okay, we'll tag team it.
Let's break it down girl by girl.
Yeah.
So the first girl to get the pants is Lena.
Well, hold on. First, we need the basic premise. Okay, so for those of you who are unaware with the basic premise, it's these four girls.
They have been best friends their entire lives.
Since before they were born.
Their moms all did prenatal yoga together, and they were all born within a week of each other.
Yes.
And they've just been best friends, girl power, their entire lives.
Even though they're so different.
They're so different.
They are nothing alike.
Yeah, there's the sporty one, and there's the shy one, and there's the edgy one, and there's the Hispanic one. Whose personality, according to the movie, is being Hispanic.
And a writer.
I'm going to get to that. So they're best friends, and then it happens that the summer after they turn 16, three out of the four of them are all going away for the summer.
They are about to spend their first summer apart.
They're going
to
be apart for the first time. And they also happen to find this magic pair of pants at a department store. And even though they all have very different body types, like Blake Lively's character is very athletic
and tall.
And Alexis Bledel's, you know, she's Rory Gilmore. She's kind of a skinny little wisp of a girl. And, you know, and then, like, America Ferrera's playing, you know, a thick, curvy Hispanic woman. And all four of them, the pants fit perfectly, and they look amazing, so they must be magic.
Okay, so they split up into four different places. The first is Rory. Lena is going to Greece. She does not seem to speak Greek, but her family is Greek, so she's going to meet her family in Greece for the first time. Right after meeting there, when she is first wearing the pants, she almost drowns, and the pants catch on a boat. But a pretty? Sure.
I think pretty, in air quotes, describes most of the men in this movie.
Every man in this movie. Anyway, a pretty man saves her, and when she, like, begins to tell her grandma about it, she finds out that this boy has been in a feud of some sort over money and fish. That's all we're told.
Yeah, their families have hated each other for generations.
Since their grandparents, sure. And so they can't date. But then they keep meeting up, and she keeps looking for him, and he keeps being
around.
Attractive? Sure.
He's there. That's his main...
They keep running into each other and having vague chemistry of some kind, allegedly. Chemistry in air quotes,
it's
you understand.
Big. I think we need a lot of air quotes for this movie.
So I think the alleged chemistry is the important point here. They keep having alleged chemistry until her grandparents catch them together at a party full of adults. Because he is a college student. Like, she's 16, he's a college student, in the theme that we're going to see here. But then her grandpa, who hasn't popped up before, is there, and his heart is broken by the fact she's dating this boy. And she gives this whole speech about, people say I'm like my ya-ya, but I'm like you, grandpa, because I saw a decision I had to make and go for it because I'm in love, grandpa. I'm in love.
And it says, go to him.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I don't even know who this man is because he hasn't popped up before this except to silently lead a donkey around.
Yeah, he's been in the background the entire movie, and then apparently we're supposed to know who he is.
And so she goes to him when he's leaving back to go to college again.
And they mac it out on the pier.
Yeah, they make out for like a minute on a boat.
They make out for like 1 million years.
They make out for much longer than I am comfortable watching anyone make out, except when I am the one personally making out, and even then it might be a little too long.
It was a little long.
Okay, and like, this boat is about to leave.
Like, the boat is
you
about
understand?
To leave.
Like, that's rude, kids.
I like how Kira's talking at the computer, like you can all hear her on the other end of the screen. The
yes.
microphone's over here.
Yeah, oh, right. Okay.
So that's
actually gonna move it.
That's what happens with Lena. Then we go, let's go next to Bridget. Now, Bridget, we learn.
I can handle Bridget, okay? So Bridget.
Well, the first thing we learn about Bridget.
Yeah, the first thing we learn about Bridget is that apparently when Bridget was younger, her mother committed suicide.
Right, and her mother seems to have some sort of mental health problem because she had episodes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is the trauma that's kind of hanging over Bridget and her entire subplot.
Yeah.
So she goes to soccer camp in Baja, and...
Why is in Baja? There's no, like...
Her plot...
It's all American kids.
I can handle Bridget's plot because nothing happens in it. So so she goes to a summer camp in Baja for soccer, and there's, like, a bit of a subplot where she's, like, being a ball hog and trying too hard to be competitive because there's a boy who's one of the coaches, so he is also a college student. And she sees him and immediately decides that she wants him because he's attractive?
Allegedly.
While we were watching the movie, I said out loud, "You're not Chad Michael Murray, but you come from the same factory." Like, that's what he looks like.
No, like, it's like if the Chad Michael, no offense to the actor, I'm sure he's a fine, you know, a nice man, but it's like if the Chad Michael Murray mold got dented and kind of fell off and they still tried to use it, you'd get Soccer Man.
Yeah, pretty much.
Sorry, Mike Vogel.
So does he have a name or is he just Soccer Man?
Eric.
He had a name.
Okay,
so she's decided that she wants a piece of Eric, and nothing gets between Bridget and the man that she wants.
Or the anything
Bridget
she
sees
wants.
Eric, and she says that is a hottie with a body, and I am going to make out with him.
Yes.
He is also the only man at soccer camp, so there's not
apparently,
much competition.
Yeah, well, there were a couple other dudes in the background, but she's decided Eric is what she wants. So there's just a couple scenes of her flirting with him and him kind of being standoffish because... he's the coach at this camp, and she's one of the campers, and all of this. And she, like, follows him to a cantina out of town, and she's, like, grinding up on him and trying to dance with him, and he, you know, does the responsible adult thing and tells her, "I can't do this," and leaves. And so a good two-thirds of the way through the movie, we just have this scene where she, like, decides that she's gonna make it happen, and so she does that, like, you know, tie-a-knot sweater thing, like the sexy Daisy Duke tie-a-knot in the sweater thing.
But only wearing a bra underneath.
Only wearing a bra, and, you know, just she's basically just wearing a bikini and then having the thing tied. And then she walks down to the beach, and apparently Eric just has, like, weird boob radar and knows that she's there, so he follows her. And then they make out, and it is heavily implied but never outright stated that they have sex on the beach.
Yeah.
And that was her first time. So then she just feels devastated afterward, like, this is what she really, really wanted, but now that she's done it, she just feels empty, and she doesn't understand why, and she doesn't get it, and so she goes home after camp, and the other girls, and we'll get to why there's more than one of them, but they have a little girl powwow, and they have I think you said it best, Kiri, that they just take all the subtext and make it text.
Yeah.
Of, like, you know, she's just always this thrill seeker because she wants to prove that she's happy and she's active and she's not like her mom, because her mom, the implication I got was her mom was manic depressive.
Yeah.
These problems.
I want to talk later about mental health in this movie.
Oh, absolutely. So that's a thing. And her girlfriends cheer her up and she feels better and it's all okay. And so just, like, that wasn't an issue. And so at the very, right near the end of the movie, her dog takes the magic pants and runs out of the house. She chases after her dog with the magic pants. And then she finds Eric in her neighborhood.
God,
meaning
fucking damn it.
He got her personal information.
Somehow.
And then used that to track her down where she lives, which just, there's a lot of.
Fuck.
There's a lot of it. As someone who has been a counselor at a summer camp for teenagers, I'm 90% certain.
Who was in college when they were in
high school. And I was in college when they were in high school. And we got a very long talking to about not fraternizing with the students. I'm pretty sure I couldn't have done that. I'm pretty sure there were security measures in place to make sure I couldn't do that. But anyway, he happened to be looking for her to give her back something. Or no, he just wanted to see her.
Yes, and have a conversation.
Yeah, and apologize. He does the stand-up thing and apologizes because he was the adult in the situation and he handled it badly and he's sorry. So, you know, he did a bad thing, but he tried to own up to it. And then she's just like, "That's okay, I'm okay." And he goes, "Oh, well, hey, when you're 20 and, like, a super sexy soccer
legal,
star,
call me."
Yeah, when you're legal, call me. We're just like, "Oh,
so bad. That scene.
You almost made it better. You almost fixed it, and then you just threw it right out."
So let's move on.
Let's move on.
Let's move on before we feel too creepy. Let's move on to Tibby.
Can I do Tibby?
Oh, yes,
you may. Kiri, go ahead and do Tibby.
Tibby was my favorite as a child. So
of course she was.
Yes, I feel a special affection for her.
This sounds about right.
And Tibby is the one girl who is not going anywhere for the summer. She is stuck at home in suburban Maryland working at Walman's.
Which is totally not Walmart.
Or Walgreens.
Definitely. No, not at all. And you see, the thing about Tibby is that her whole deal is that she's not part of your system, man. And she is rebellious and cynical.
In a hot topic kind of way.
Yeah, yeah.
In a really ineffectual kind of way.
Yeah, it's very recognizably teenage edgy.
Mm-hmm.
And so what she's doing during the summer is she is making what she calls a succumentary, where she is going to interview random people.
Who are lame.
Yes, and she will make fun of them, and it will be an act of great justice somehow in her mind. Just, you know, making fun of people she thinks are losers. And then one day at work, she hears a crash and goes to see what's going on.
While she's wearing the pants.
Yes. And so she goes to see...
Was she wearing the pants?
Yeah, she was wearing the pants.
She wasn't wearing the pants. The pants got mailed to Bailey.
The pants pants started in Greece.
Oh, right. She didn't have the pants.
Yeah, she didn't have the pants.
Right. And so she sees that there's this 12-year-old girl who's fainted in an aisle. And, you know, something's clearly wrong with her somehow. So this child gets carted out. The next day or a couple of days later, the worst fucking thing happens. The most contrived... This was where you said out loud bullshit.
Yes, this is the first of many times in this movie. I out loud just said bullshit.
Yes.
I love this movie.
See, there are contrivances, and the film makes excuses for these contrivances by saying, you know, it's the magic luck of the pants.
It's the magic of the pants. But the pants weren't in this equation.
No, the pants were in the equation,
sorry.
Yes, because what happens, you see, is Tibby gets a knock on her door, goes to see who it is. It's Bailey who says... Who she has the pants because
the
they were...
The little girl from the store.
Yes. They were mismailed to her.
Because they happen to live on the same street.
Yes. And so she has come to return them. And Tibby's like, okay, whatever. But then Bailey kind of starts prying in a precocious small child way. She comes inside, you know, and she asks about Tibby's documentary and... You know, asks all these personal questions, and she and Tibby kind of get this banter going.
It's also worth noting that Tibby seems to have a less than responsible mother and an apparently absent father, and there is a small child.
Yeah.
But you say that like it's important. It's not. It doesn't come up, really. It's just a thing to make Tibby feel resentful.
I think it's important as background information for why Tibby feels so put down by the world.
Yeah, we'll get into it later. I actually have a lot of thoughts about that, of course. Running theme that you'll see. But, so basically, yeah, Tibby is often saddled with responsibility of taking care of her baby siblings. And so she's trying to do that and take care of all this stressful stuff while Bailey is kind of, like, angling her way in. And she asks to be Tibby's assistant. And so they go around interviewing people. And there is this very, well, later in this movie, but relevant to right now, there's this moment where Tibby calls Bailey annoying because Bailey asks her documentary subjects questions.
And yeah, tries to why get to would know you want to do that?
No, and actually, I really like this personally in a legitimate way because it is... It kind of, like, fits into the whole theme of how Tibby doesn't really see the people she's interviewing as people.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, she thinks that they're pathetic and sad and, you know, not really worthy of her empathy or respect, but Bailey does. And so Bailey actually talks to them like human beings, and Tibby thinks that's weird, but...
If we were to rank the characters' storylines on from least sucky to suckiest, I think Tibby's would make it in the top half percentile.
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. Top two.
Yeah.
Top two of the four.
Like, they meet a couple different townies, they meet girls running a lemonade stand, they meet a gamer by the name of Brian McBrien. Grant, do you want to talk about Brian McBrien?
Let's talk about Brian McBrien later. Let's just stick with the summary for here. I will have words about Brian McBrien.
Okay, well, yes, she meets a gamer named Brian McBrien. And so anyway, so they're doing all this stuff later, and then one day, Bailey is not there. with Tibby's equipment to help her, and so Tibby goes to Bailey's house trying to figure out where she is, and Bailey's neighbors tell her that Bailey's at the hospital because she has leukemia.
And it's fairly advanced leukemia. It's to the point where they've given up on trying to treat it.
Yes.
It's just, you know, there's no hope for her, then they've just stopped treatment.
Yes, and so it turns out that this is one of those narratives where an inspirational child with cancer comes to teach a main character a lesson, but no. I feel like it does play into that trope, and it's very bad, but also I like the acting and Tibby's kind of growth from here on out, because afterwards Bailey shows up at the store and with the equipment, and Tibby is unusually nice to her, and just, even though Bailey is kind of like apologizing for being late and whatnot, and Bailey realizes that, you know, Tibby's giving her this like special treatment because mm-hmm. she knows now, and so when Tibby invites her to go along and they'll do the documentary stuff, Bailey's like, are you just doing this because you feel bad for me because I'm the kid with cancer? And Tibby's like, yeah, I guess so. And then they just kind of like sit with that and go on. And I thought that was a nice moment. And so, yeah, we have more documentary stuff and just like conversations about life and death. And Bailey, of course, is a wise preteen.
Of course.
Yeah, Grant's quote here was, that's one eloquent-ass 12-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Just having a terminal illness suddenly makes you wise beyond your years.
Yeah, it's not great. Yeah.
You know what else isn't great? Where it goes from there.
Yeah. Do you want to take this?
So
it's just so much.
So after a time, you know, Bailey's in the hospital, mm-hmm. and it's looking like she's probably not going to be leaving the hospital. And so Tibby just kind of avoids going to visit her for a long time because she doesn't want to confront it. And then she finally does, you know, like, okay, I need to go visit her in the hospital and see her before she's gone. And so she goes, and Bailey's in the hospital, and, you know, she's got, like, the bags under her eyes. That's how you know in a movie that someone's dying.
Yeah. Suddenly this child goes from being 100% fine to flip the switch to I'm dying. Yeah.
And so they have this conversation at like, Bailey's bedside.
The magic pants brought me to you.
Yeah, this, like, the magic pants didn't... Or, you know, you need to, or so Tibby's very distraught. She's like, Bailey, you need to wear the pants. They're magic. They'll make you okay.
They'll give you a miracle.
Yeah, they'll give you a miracle.
And it'll... Bailey says, but they already gave me a miracle. They brought me to you.
And at this point, I threw my pencil at the screen.
Yeah.
Because, like.
Yeah, that was.
It's not even just the line being cheesy, but the way it was directed and everything was just like, don't say it. Don't you dare fucking say it. They brought me to you. God damn it.
So then Bailey dies.
Yeah, so Bailey dies and Tibby is distraught. And
I just want to say that is not in the book. Like, they brought me to you, because they don't bring Bailey to her. In the book.
Right, because it plays out differently in the book.
Yeah, and you can just tell that in the adaptational process, you know, the story, it's mostly pretty loyal, but it just has this film of extra Hollywood gloss mm-hmm. over it.
And that was definitely the most Hollywood moment in the entire movie.
Yeah, so that's how you get lines like that are just inexcusable.
Okay, and really, so she ends up making her documentary about Bailey in the end, as opposed to being about how sucky life is. No, I want to do Carmen, if that's okay.
Do Carmen. You can do it.
We can.
We can do it together.
Carmen has the best storyline, is
Carmen
the thing.
Carmen 100% has the best storyline. We can share it.
So they're in a cage match about it now, and I'm just going to watch.
So, okay. So America Ferrera plays Carmen, and the thing about Carmen is that her father is garbage.
Her father is absolute garbage. Yeah, the message of this movie is that dads are bad. So this dad, she's seen him a couple of times growing up. Her parents are divorced, but her dad moved away to South Carolina, and she's going to see him over the summer.
Also, it should be noted that Carmen is specifically biracial. Her mom is Puerto Rican, and her dad is white.
Yes. She. Her mom's Puerto Rican, her dad's white, and so she goes to visit her white dad. He kind of looks like we've mentioned it already once before, actually. If any of you have played the new PS4 Spider-Man, he looks like PS4 Norman Osborn.
Yeah.
He's
kind of got this like vaguely suburban square Skeletor look to his face.
Yeah, he looks like Norman Osborn, but anyway, her dad picks her up from the bus station and is just like, "Surprise, I have a girlfriend who lives with me and she has two kids and we're getting married."
Yeah, we're getting married.
It's just like, oh, my dad has this entire secret life that he never bothered.
And I live in the suburbs, even though I used to hate the suburbs.
Yeah, and so it's actually, it's not that different from like the suburban hellscape we saw recently on that episode of Gilmore Girls. Mm-hmm. There's like, it's this perfect blonde family with perfect blonde children. And, like, the son is this weirdo who never talks, and the daughter is just, like, skinny and blonde and perfect. And it's just this weird, bizarro world. Like, they all sit around a dinner table and laugh, and they don't answer the phone during dinner. Except apparently her dad and his girlfriend met because he accidentally called her number, and somehow a wrong number turned into a date. I really want to know what moves he used to make that happen.
That was weird. That is also in the book. I'm pretty sure. Anyway, carry on.
So it becomes clear very quickly that he is being the dad to these kids that he wasn't to her. Suddenly he's saying grace, even though he wouldn't go to church. He says he's going to play tennis with her, but he goes to Paul's soccer game. Basically pretends not to know Spanish because she starts speaking Spanish like, oh, you'd always speak it all the time in the house. And he's like, that's rude. Don't speak Spanish around the rest of the family. They don't speak Spanish. And this mismatch comes to a head in one weird, awkward scene where Carmen oversleeps and the maid comes in. And the maid is a like Hispanic Spanish speaking woman who doesn't speak very good English. And Carmen doesn't know what to do with the fact that this, like, weird white family that she doesn't quite belong to has a Hispanic maid, and so she's like, I'm gonna do my own sheets.
Yeah. That's actually a really interesting movie original moment that it's one of the few things that I think didn't, like, flop badly. But
yeah, that was a good scene. That was a good scene. And so, like, there's a whole sub-drama that the wedding is falling apart because the venue flooded, and so they're trying to figure things out. And so Carmen's particular struggle kind of comes to a head when they're out they're getting fitted for the bridesmaid dresses. And she does not fit at all into her bridesmaid dress. It is way too small for her because she's a bigger lady. And so then there's this whole, like, it's like this kind of nightmare scene of like, oh, well, we're going to need to take this section out. Oh, yeah, way out. I hope we have enough fabric in the back for it. It's like, these dress shop employees have not been trained at all on how to not, like, be horrible to their customers. Because you don't say that, even if it's true, you don't say that when the customer's standing right there.
Well, also, I'm sorry, this might be a stereotype because of America's obesity problem, but are you saying that in the land of biscuits and gravy, they've never seen a woman as large as America Ferrera? Because she's not that big.
No, she's not that
big. She's still, like, pretty and curvy. Like, she's not into the realm of obese.
Yeah, it's not like she's morbidly obese or anything. She's just a little on the thicker side, and that's fine. And, like, yeah, but, like, bullshit.
And they just treat her horribly.
Yeah, they treat her horribly. So she has a bit of a fully justified temper tantrum and storms out of the place. And so she kind of wanders around and gets a cab home, and she's kind of figuring, like, oh, they're probably out searching for me, so I'll just wait for them to show up. And then she hears laughing when she's sitting on the front stoop, and she realizes they're all just sitting down and having a nice family dinner.
Yeah. Without her.
Without her, and, like, don't seem at all concerned that she's missing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once again, remind me to talk about parents in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she just chucks a rock at their window and goes home.
Yeah, she gets on a bus, calls Tibby, and leaves.
Carmen is, like, the objectively best character.
Yeah, no, she is.
Thug life, well, and storms out.
America Ferrera made her the most sympathetic character, I think.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so she gets on this bus, thug lifes it out. Her mom, first of all, is like, well, I told you so. And it's like, what are you doing? How is this your parenting style? And then Tibby convinces her to call her dad and tell her, I'm angry at you. You hurt me. You're replacing me. How dare you? Like, how dare you? And he says, I'm sorry. And she says, that's not enough. So, of course, when all the other sisters get home, they basically kidnap her, throw her in the car, throw her in the pants, drive her to the wedding, and force her to sit there. And then her dad has a change of heart. because she's wearing the pants, who knows what would have happened if she wasn't wearing the pants.
If she wasn't wearing the pants, then he would have just been like, I'm sorry, are you my daughter?
Yeah, no, and he says, oh, well, my daughter is special and needs to be here, and lets her stand up in the wedding. And the movie ends with all of them gathered around a table in a gazebo, smiling and laughing over the sisterhood of the traveling pants.
Just so everyone is aware, I have read the books, like we've mentioned. I'm not going to say I know a bunch of stuff, because I'm probably going to forget a lot, actually. We're drinking, we need alcohol to cope, but, so Paige and Grant are just coming from this from a solely movie perspective, so I have to justify the existence of a lot of this and Please. Explain how it wasn't like this
so
originally.
So I'm just gonna jump right into what I thought.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Let's do it. So actually, no. Kiri, what did you think?
Well, the thing is that I saw the movie when I was a kid, when it came out, and I really loved it, of course, because I love the books, and it's a pretty, you know, it has its heart in the right place.
Uh-huh, I can see that.
And I actually did rewatch it when it was on Netflix a while ago, and I was like, yeah, I love this. This gives me a nice, warm, nostalgic glow.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we were planning this, I was like, okay, Grant and Paige will probably hate this, because, you know, it's so earnest and sincere about these, like, really,
friendship. Like, sisterhood.
Children with cancer.
Children with cancer.
But, yeah, so it has these kind of, like, cheesed up elements, but, you know, I'm still going to defend it and explain why it's good, and I realized I can't actually...
You have 12 seconds.
You can't?
You can't?
I still love a lot of little individual parts of it, but the whole is very,
So, okay, so I'm just going to say... I didn't hate it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I didn't hate it.
Mm-hmm.
I was very confused
mm-hmm.
in certain places, and I did throw my pencil at the screen at one point, but...
So did I.
So did you. Yeah.
You did twice.
Yeah.
Did you throw your pencil, Paige?
No.
No, Paige had restraint.
Okay, yes,
she never
Paige
threw.
Is the civilized one of us.
So, here's the thing, right? I can tell, I would say, looking at it, disregarding the books, because I know nothing about the books,
mm-hmm.
looking at this just as its own standalone film, I can say objectively it is not good.
Yeah.
However, that does not mean I did not enjoy watching it. It falls in that realm
yeah.
where if the fact that I was sitting here with friends and alcohol watching this movie, I enjoyed myself.
Yeah. See, that's my...
Okay, but had you been in theaters?
Oh, if I had been in theaters... Well, now, if I'd seen it in theaters in 2005...
See,
then
this
it has
this
Blake Lively.
Just...
No, ignore that.
No, I think if I'd seen it in theaters in 2005, I probably would have hated it.
Okay.
Because I would have been a 13-year-old boy watching The Sisterhood
yeah,
of the Traveling Pants.
You were not the demographic.
I was not the target demographic. Blake Lively would have been a plus, because Blake Lively does spend a lot of time scantily clad in this movie, but I don't think it would have saved it for my 13-year-old self.
Okay, so I did watch it when I was 13 in theaters, but without that same affection. I watched it as a youth group activity, and I hated it so much that I tried, like, when they announced the second event, I personally, I'm not proud of this, brigaded it until the event got canceled for my small youth group. I played up the, it had teen sex in it, even though, like, the whole point of it was that she was having teen sex to, like, you know, ignore her feelings.
And it's never straight up even stated that she had teen sex. You could very easily be like, oh no, honey, they just kissed.
Yeah. Oh yes, it was her first time kissing.
Uh-huh.
Sure. So I played that up until the event was quietly canceled, and I rejoiced. Because, I'm sorry, even with the joy of friends, I did not like this movie. I thought America Ferrera did a great job. I thought that there were, like, so Carmen's plot wasn't bad, but I had three other girls that I had to sit through, and I had so many feelings of why this was problematic, but also not enjoyable.
I do want to say, in defense of my girl, Amber Tamblyn, she is a really good actress who did a good job with some really cringy material.
She did. Mm. She worked with what she was given, but what she was given was written by the lesser of two Efrons.
Yeah, so my thoughts in summary, like, I really liked Carmen's plot in general. I thought that that was easily the highlight of the movie. At some point here, I wrote down, why can't we just have an entire movie about Carmen?
Fair.
And it was like, I could get behind it, because it's like, yeah, your dad's kind of crappy and doesn't tell you things going on in his life. I know that feel. So I was able to actually personally identify with Carmen's plot more than I thought I would identify with any of the traveling pant sisters. And actually, the thing is, the parts that I enjoyed most were the parts that were the most just, like, earnest and the other word you used. So as a result, I liked a lot of Tibby's plot, too. I thought it worked out really well. But, yeah, Bridget and Lena's plots both just seemed like filler.
The problem with Bridget and Lena is that in the film, they have these romance subplots that are very thinly sketched, and you don't understand why they're having,
neither of the boys, like, have any personality.
Yeah, and Bridget's is a little bit better because they make it clear that it's not actually about him, it's about her need to, like, get away from her own issues.
Hey,
yeah.
That's not fair. Greek guy had a personality. His personality was orphan.
That's true. His parents died in a car crash when he was 12.
Well, my problem was, I mean, don't get me wrong, your dad was a bastard. But to get the drama they wanted, they had it in such broad, unrealistic strokes.
Particularly just them sitting down having happy family dinner when she was missing didn't ring
that
true
didn't
to
ring
me.
True. The way that, like Bailey didn't ring true as the wise cancer survivor, but she also didn't ring true as the kid who was a brat when she first met Tibby, but then is super nice to everyone else when she first meets them. That didn't make sense to me. Like, Lena wasn't interesting, Bridget wasn't interesting.
I'd have to watch it again, but I felt like Bailey was kind of reflecting Tibby in that way. Like, she got really snarky with her because Tibby was abrasive.
Yeah, but we don't see that in the way she interacts with anyone else, and we see it from...
Yeah, because other people are nice, and Tibby's a shithead.
Well, but I mean, even when Tibby first meets her, she's like, I gave you your wallet, and she's like, oh, you stole my money, and it's like, what are you doing, child?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But also just... There was so much of it for this plot to happen that has to not make sense. Because either parents are completely absent, or parents are awful and overbearing. Like Lena's
sometimes
parents.
Both.
Yeah, and sometimes both. It just there were so many things
I think
that asked us to to go into teen soap world in the soccer camp. The oldest adult supervision is teenagers. There are not camp counselors in the barracks, even though most teen camps have someone, you know, sleeping with the kids to make sure they don't sneak out at night and have sex with a camp counselor. In Lena's plot, she's there with her, like, giant Greek family, but we never see them. We just see her going out with a boy who they have no idea she's going out with in this small town where everyone knows everyone. Carmen, where her dad is just really absent, even when he's there, but then her mom is also just like, I told you so about your dad. And like,
I have things to say about this. But
she doesn't call him like her mom all summer, it seems like. And when she comes home, she calls Tibby first. You know, like when they get home, when Lena gets home from Greece, her friends meet her at the airplane.
Yeah, and her parents are just not there.
Her parents are not there. But the one that I think is most egregious is with Bailey. This small child who is dying of cancer, she is 12.
We literally never see her parents.
We never see her parents in the entire movie. While she's about to die of leukemia, she's running around the city with some unknown teenage girl filming stuff, and perfectly fine. And then her last night in the hospital, her parents are nowhere to be seen. I don't know how this works, but I would assume if you're a parent of a 12-year-old who is dying and who is very close to the end, you would be with them every single night. But no, her last night on Earth, she spends with a teenage girl she met a couple weeks ago. And
yeah.
That is her deep moment. And, like, even they sit out looking up at the stars, and it's like, who is letting a 12-year-old out at, like, any 12-year-old, but especially a cancer-stricken one, out at night to look up at the stars and have deep conversations with a 16-year-old girl?
Also, how are there that many stars out in a suburb?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's... There is a quick blink and you miss it throwaway line where it is mentioned that Bailey does indeed have a mother. And if that line was not in the movie, you could just assume that not only is Bailey a child with cancer, she is a homeless child with cancer.
Yeah, no kidding.
Like, I...
who is not a ward of any state. And then, you know, meanwhile, we have the plot of Bridget's mom being dead, which mm-hmm. is important, but also her dad seems to be fairly absent. Mm-hmm. The only thing we see of him other than him picking her up is sending her a letter that basically is like, glad you're at camp, hope you're well, love, Dad, and it's typed.
Yeah. He's obviously grown distant because he's dealing with his own grief.
But yeah, that is definitely intentional, so I give them some flexibility with that. But...
No, but that would be more intentional if anyone else had present parents to contrast that with.
That's true.
She's talking about how much it hurts her that her mom is dead. It's like everyone else's parents might as well be dead.
Can I talk about Carmen's mom? Actually,
yeah, please talk about Carmen's mom.
So the thing is that in the movie, when Carmen goes home after throwing the rock thug life, and she meets up with Tibby, she and Tibby have a fight briefly.
Yes. We glossed over that part.
Yes, yes. And then later, you know, they make up and they have a conversation where Carmen says, you know, I'm mad at my dad and that's hard for me to admit. I don't know why. I have no problem being mad at you. And Tibby says, it's probably easier to be mad at someone that you know loves you because you can be sure that that relationship is going to be stable and it's not going to be threatened if you get mad. But in the book, that conversation is with Carmen's mom.
Which makes more sense.
That makes a lot more sense.
Yes, yes. Carmen says the whole thing about not having... problem being mad at her mom, and her mom has the "yeah, I noticed" line.
Why would you change that? That's so much better if it's with her mother.
Because Carmen and her mom are basically tight in the books, because it's just them. They should have kept it as her mom. I understand them wanting to make it about Carmen and Tibby's friendship.
So that there could be some interaction between the girls up to the beginning and the end?
Yeah, yeah. But it's just frustrating because, you know, without that, Carmen's mom in the movie comes off like this unsympathetic asshole.
Yeah.
Well, I think the central issue here is that the format, I'm sure this format worked great in the books, but it's just really hard to make a good cohesive film when you establish four main characters and then send them to literally separate fucking parts of the world.
It's very choppy.
Yeah, a lot of studios actually passed on this movie originally because executives were nervous about making...
it's a challenge.
With four protagonists and their own supporting cast.
And you need to shoot on location. I mean, I'm imagining a lot of that was on location or very elaborate sets.
Yeah, Greece was definitely on location.
Yeah, in four different places.
Yeah, I know it sounds odd in our post-Infinity War world, but these girls did not have their own movies of build-up before that.
No, I almost would have preferred that.
Yeah.
I think this could have worked as like a mini-series, right? So that you can really take your time to build up everything. And as a result, we ended up with like two half-baked plots, Tibby and Carmen. Like, and even Tibby's kind of faltered at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, so another thing I want to talk about that really, really struck me was that I think the major thing dragging this movie down, even more so than the stuff we've already talked about, is just that what we were just talking about, of it being four separate stories, meant that it was very difficult to keep a consistent tone.
Yeah.
The movie was tonally all over the place. In the span of 5 minutes, less, like 3 minutes, we had like, oh, Bailey has cancer, but... then Lena goes on a nice date with the Greek boy and he teaches her how to ride a Vespa and they kiss on the boat in the moonlight. But then, like, Carmen, something bad happened with Carmen.
Yeah.
And then it went to, like, happy, bouncy music of
Bridget jogging.
Of Bridget jogging and flirting with this guy who's, like, many years older than her.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just, like, I was having tonal whiplash the entire film. And so there were very few moments where I really got to actually sit with the emotion that was trying to be conveyed.
The movie also has weird views of mental health.
See, they do the thing that TV and movies do sometimes when they handle mental illness badly, where it's like, oh, this person killed themselves because they weren't strong enough.
I hated that. It's about, your mother, you're not going to end up like your mom because she wasn't strong like you and she didn't have the good friends that you have. And it's like, okay... that's not...
nope.
That's not how that works.
Yeah, not how any of that works.
Let's not send the message to suicidal people that they're just not strong enough. And let's also not send the message to people who had who are friends of suicidal people that they need to be good friends or their friend's going to kill themselves.
Speaking of which, we need to throw a content warning at the beginning of this episode.
We probably should mention that at the beginning,
Well, and it's also just weird. Like, I feel like there was a draft somewhere where mental health was a more central topic.
Yeah.
Because they definitely talk about her mom's episodes. So it implies that she had manic or depressive episodes. You know, her mom committed suicide because of either a depressive, like, it seems like because of a depressive episode. But also they talk about, like, they just make a casual, like, jokey reference to uppers. And then at the beginning of the movie, you know, they ask,
that went
like,
over my head.
If Tibby's, like, somebody else, like, completely unrelated to the uppers comment, they ask if Tibby's been taking her happy pills. And she said, no, I'm saving them for the summer when I have to be stocking shelves.
Like, I missed that.
Yeah, they keep talking about, like, medication and mental health, but it's never, like, it's just a weird, like...
It's atmospheric.
It's a creepy kid standing in the corner that no one addresses.
Yeah, so it was really weird. I agree. I'd missed that comment about Tibby. Yeah. But, yeah, there's just this weird mental health through line that never becomes a thing.
And that also implies that the reason Tibby is grumpy and needs, like, medication... is because she hasn't met a cancer child who has taught her how to love yet.
Yeah, getting away from mental illness, we now have physical illness used as a method of enlightenment, which is, of course, a trope with its own horrible history.
Yeah, so... But I have... Actually, can I ask a question?
Let's move on to questions. I think
okay, questions
we could talk about. We could talk about what we thought for a while, but I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Let's just...
And there's four whole storylines that we all have a lot to say about, so let's just get into questions.
Yeah, so there... I don't want to weigh us down with questions, because I know, Grant, I saw a lot of question marks on your paper.
I think those are the most questions I've ever had.
But...
Although a couple of them actually got answered, so.
Yeah, but I have, like, there are questions I don't need answered, like, why is mail delivered via donkey in Greece, and why didn't Lena get tan? I don't care about the answers
to
that.
I was wondering about that. She shows up still perfectly pasty white Alexis Bledel.
Yeah. I have two questions. One, and they're both about Carmen's dad's wedding. One, if Carmen hadn't been wearing the pants at Carmen's dad's wedding, would he have just been crappy to her?
It's the magic of the pants.
Actually, I lied. I have one more question that's also about Carmen. The one thing we didn't mention is that it's implied that Tibby kind of has this romance with this gamer guy, Brian McBrien, who Grant's going to have questions about. But can we deal with the fact that America Ferrera, who is a larger Latina woman... doesn't get a love interest while all the skinny, pretty white, like, and not that America Ferrera isn't pretty, but all the skinny white women get love interests?
Yeah, and I just want to say that this is not even a thing where I'm just like, oh, it's the movie, the book's better. No, the books have this problem too. All of the girls have endgame love interests that you see from the first installment, and Carmen in the book, she does get to date a couple of different guys, but,
she gets to be a strong, independent woman who don't need no man.
Actually, I think, like, from what I was reading about the fifth book, she even ends up unattached.
Yeah, because she has this guy that she's with, but then, you know, part of her arc is about realizing he's a jerk, so she breaks up with him at the end.
Yeah.
Right.
But, yeah.
So, my last question.
Oh, another thing, actually, that I have that's just related to this is Carmen being the writer in the movie.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to ask about that. Yeah, they say, and me, Carmen, the writer, and then she never writes a fucking word the rest of the movie.
Yes. She cuts letters, and all of them write letters.
Yeah, like, what? Is there a whole subplot of, like, Carmen working on the great American novel that got cut?
The thing is that in the books, Carmen doesn't have writing. She doesn't have a thing. In the prologue of the first book, you know, she goes through, she's like, Lena's the artist, Bridget's the jock, Tibby's the rebel filmmaker. I don't really have a thing. I'm just the one with the bad temper.
And so then over the course of the series, she discovers writing?
No, actually, she gets into acting. But,
oh, okay.
But, yeah.
So you don't do an outsider's thing where at the end it's like, and she wrote the book.
Yeah. I
like to call that a BFG thing.
I was thinking about it and wondering if, even if the racial politics of this movie are still really awkward in places, I was kind of wondering if somebody read that and was like, oh, maybe we shouldn't have our Latina character be like, my friends all have really specific interests and I'm just so emotional.
I could see them wanting to step away from, like, the fiery Latina stereotype.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And that's a good, that's probably a good move, yeah. But yeah, they just gave her a character trait and yeah. then never followed up on it.
Yeah.
But I want to get back to my
question. Yeah, yeah, what's your next question?
So, Carmen's dad's wedding is a kind of small, intimate thing. There are probably like 30 or 40 people in attendance.
Small wedding.
Yeah. So how do they have four extra chairs for, you know, four uninvited guests at this wedding, or, you know, three uninvited guests at this wedding, and one guest who they thought would be standing up? So they have, why do they have enough chairs?
I mean, that's easy. We have the same thing at our wedding. It's just sometimes people say they're going to come and then cancel the night before.
There are like 20 people, and I'm guessing they were all from town.
Maybe they weren't.
No, I don't believe it. As someone who had to, like, try to work out an RSVP list, that does not happen. No.
Pretty sure we had four last-minute cancellations at our wedding. Do you have any other questions?
No, I'm good.
Okay, I have a couple. So this one actually isn't necessarily about the movie, but I noticed it. So in just the opening, we didn't even talk about how we literally start with the pants being made. Okay? We start with the construction of the magic pants.
In fairness, it's basically stylistic for the credits.
Yes, so. But nonetheless. But anyway, so we get just a quick just like time-lapse of their childhood together. And it was kind of weird the way that we are told as the audience about Tibby's somewhat strange life situation mm-hmm. of there being young, much younger siblings is that the four girls seem like they're having a sleepover or something mm-hmm. and they're making a movie together
yeah.
that's about Tibby's feelings about this. And so it establishes the situation. It further establishes their friendship. It establishes Tibby as the filmmaker. It's all good. But I have to ask, because this is something that I remember being a thing when I was around that age. So is, like, all getting together on sleepovers and making movies together some, like, weird universal preteen bonding ritual?
Yep.
Because I definitely had friends who, like, female friends who did that when we were preteens.
I was
and going, told me about it, but I wasn't allowed because it was a girls only thing.
I did it at a birthday party. I had a movie making birthday party where we split into two teams and each made our own movie. And then I was in my friend Liz's movie about how you shouldn't do drugs. That was for class.
I was about to say that I've never done that, but there was, like, a sleepover in, like, fifth or sixth grade where that did happen, so.
Well, this seems to be one of those strange universal things.
Mm-hmm. I also didn't have as much money, but I did have a reel-to-reel. Did a lot of recording on that.
There you go. Yeah, so that's not about the movie, but it struck me. When Bridget is going to the airport, her dad walks her all the way up to the gate. When
in
this movie was made in 2005, you can't do that anymore post 9/11. That's not a question. I just think it's worth pointing out.
Get your nitpick on.
Yeah. Let's see. Yeah. So Bailey has we've already kind of discussed this, but Bailey has late stage enough leukemia that they're stopping treatment. But she has absolutely no discernible signs that she's sick. I don't know a lot about leukemia. Maybe it is one of those things where you can function.
Leukemia, the silent killer.
Yeah, maybe it's one of those things where you can function pretty well right up until the end. I don't know about leukemia, but I imagine if it's advanced enough that the doctor's saying, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do, let's just stop treatment. I imagine she'd probably have something, even if it's just like, oh, sorry, I can't quite keep up with you as much because she's lower energy or something
like
that.
Yeah, the only thing they have is when she faints right at the beginning, and that's a plot device.
Yeah. That struck me as... Is there any more? Do you remember if there's anything more of that in the books?
I don't really think so. Of course, Bailey's mom also is in the book and much more active, so...
That's good to know.
So, I mean, Bailey probably does still run around with Tibby too much by herself, but... But she does have a parent who has lines.
That's good to know. Next question.
Also, they don't have that stupid thing where Bailey gets the pants by accident. No, what happens is Tibby tracks down where Bailey lives through the phone book, and she goes to give the wallet back in person.
Right.
And so she meets her mom there, and, you know, they get to talking, and eventually her mom mentions that she has leukemia. It's not this reveal halfway through.
Oh, okay. So she knows that Bailey has leukemia from the start.
It's established very early on, and we do still have that you're just being nice to me moment, but it's much earlier on establishing your friendship.
Okay. Huh.
Yeah.
I can see why they wanted to make it a reveal, but that doesn't, that still doesn't explain why they had to make magic pants contrivance.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, the pants are magic.
They
have to do magic things. Otherwise, we might not think they're magic.
Honestly, I kind of had forgotten about the pants halfway through the movie. I was like, who has the pants right now? I really wasn't tracking who had the pants through most of the movie. What percentage of this movie is just Blake Lively looking devilishly at the camera? Because I feel like that was
5%.
That was her entire plot line, was she does a thing and then she looks at the boy and like smiles and bites her lip a little bit. And I'm just like, okay, yes, we get it. Blake Lively is very pretty.
I want to meet the girl who like established her entire scheme of flirting off of this movie. Yeah, Kira, you drink your water like that wasn't you. Like, because I mean, like, just her entire scheme is just being aggressively good at sports, being aggressive towards men.
She's very aggressively flirtatious.
Yes. Yeah, it's like...
I think flirting is light for it. She just legit walks up and just, like, turns around and starts grinding her butt on him.
Yeah,
she
basically hits on him without using words.
Yeah.
She's predatory.
It's a little... If,
even though she's the younger one, it feels predatory.
Yeah, okay, so I know this is a stupid question, but why are none of them concerned about the origins of the magic fucking pants that just walked into their lives?
They're all busy with their summers.
You know, they kind of do talk about it early on a bit, and, you know, they kind of have this argument about how, you know, their pants, magic's not real, and, you know, others...
It might be Lycra.
And then others are more like... No, they came to us at this, like, big moment in our lives. It's clearly destiny of some kind. So they're not really questioning it, in part.
Okay,
And I do want to establish that the pants do not fit anyone, because Bailey does try them on and they don't fit.
Yeah, they're specifically... The power of the magic is in their friendship.
Yes.
And they basically say that the magic was in the friendships we made along the way.
Yeah, they legit at the end say that the magic was their friendship all along. We already talked about Carmen's writing. So, okay, I have one last major bone to pick.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about Brian McBrien.
So please tell me, who is Brian McBrien?
Brian McBrien, for starters, Brian McBrien is Asian, therefore he's good at video games.
For the record, Grant's mom is Chinese.
No, I'm criticizing the movie. I'm not saying that's actually true. So, of course, the Asian kid is the one who's really good at video games, and he hangs out at the convenience store.
Yeah.
It seems to be a knockoff 7-Eleven. And a fixture of every convenience store is the Game Wizard, because apparently this is still 1987. And Brian McBrien is really, really good at a cabinet for a game called Dragon's Lair. Now, here's the thing. It's Dragon's Lair 3D.
Yeah, Dragon's Lair is a real game that exists.
Yes.
It was famously made by Don Bluth.
Don Bluth.
Yeah, who also made Land Before Time, American Tail. This was his video game.
Titan A.E.
And Titan A.E.
You can't not mention Titan A.E. in this house. Brian McBrien plays Dragon's Lair 3D, which is very different. But to the best of my Googling, Dragon's Lair 3D never had an arcade cabinet release. So, this came out around the time that the movie was made, and so, at that point, arcades were basically dead. So it was just released on the home consoles at the time, the GameCube, the PlayStation 2, and the original Xbox. So he just, like, this place happens to have an arcade cabinet for a game that never had an arcade release, which is theoretically plausible, because you can just, like, make your own arcade box, stick a console on the guts of it, and make it work. Like, if you go to fancy arcades these days, they'll have, like, you know, Dragon Ball FighterZ and Street Fighter V and, like, all these console releases. It's just a PS4 inside, and the guts are all hooked up to a cabinet.
We had one at work.
Yeah, they're not official, but they exist. Now, where I have to get pedantic and take issue is at the end, when Tibby is going to visit Bailey in the hospital, and she's got a Game Boy Advance. And says, oh, yeah, Brian got me the Dragon's Lair for it. He says that it's not quite the real thing, but it's good enough. And the game never came out on the Game Boy Advance. Now, I know this is a stupid thing to nitpick about, especially because movies getting video games wrong is, like, a time-honored tradition. It was around this time that the Charlie's Angels reboot came out, I think. It was roughly the same era.
Yeah.
And that famously has a scene of someone playing Final Fantasy VIII with two controllers plugged in, which is a crime for many reasons, namely that somebody's playing Final Fantasy VIII. But I just feel like why not pick, if you're going to pick a real game, right? If you're not just going to make up a game, like, one, make up a game. That's fine. My biggest pet peeve is when they name an actual game and it doesn't work. But then pick a game that, like, why not use Mortal Kombat? That had a GBA release and arcade cabinets.
And the thing is, a 12-year-old probably shouldn't be playing it, but she's about to die.
And also, every 12-year-old played Mortal Kombat, even though they shouldn't. So that's my little soapbox about Brian McBrien and his apparent magical video game library, where he can just be like, oh, hey, here we go. I've got, like, the Atari 2600 port of Halo 2. Go ahead and play it. So that's what I got. That's my stump. I stood on it. I gave him a speech. Carmen's dad is garbage.
Carmen's dad is garbage.
Carmen's dad is garbage.
Are there any burning things that the book did better that you haven't gotten to mention?
Well, I don't really want to get into what the book did better exactly, although there are things I could talk about, like how most of it is pretty loyal, but Lena's is the one that is totally different.
You mentioned it was totally different, and yeah. It was honestly... might have been the weakest one. I'm debating whether I hated Bridget's or Lena's stories more.
Yeah, it's because, so in the book, you know, like the basic idea of Lena meeting a cute orphan named Kostos and falling for him is still there. But what happens is that there is no family feud or anything like that. When she gets there, Kostos is basically the town darling, and her grandmother loves him, and, you know, it's like, oh, Kostos is such a good boy, and, you know, the town basically raised him, you know, due to him being an orphan. Like, Lena doesn't find that out until later, and it's a whole thing, but, so what happens is that Lena does not have to fall into a lake for Kostos to ask her out. He just does one time at, like, some family party.
Because she looks like Alexis Bledel.
Yes, and she turns him down, because the thing is that Lena in the book has this thing that she can't really have in a movie where all of the actresses are gorgeous, but in the book the idea is that Lena is the hot one.
She is the most beautiful.
Yes, she is the prettiest girl in all the pants kingdom. And so,
yeah, that's hard to find somebody who is notably more attractive than Blake Lively.
Yeah, yeah. And so she is, that is the reason, that is part of why she's so shy and awkward and very cautious to kind of like approach somebody she has a crush on, because she has this very long established distrust of boys because she's so used to being objectified, albeit in a very G-rated way.
But it's fair.
Yeah. So she meets Kostos and she kind of likes him, but then she asks her out, so she's kind of like, oh no, better not do this, because she feels like he's probably just like all the other boys, right? And so Lena goes off and explores Greece and does her own thing for a while. And then she finds a secret little secluded pond. And she's like, oh, cool, this will be my special private artist cove place.
Of course.
Yes. And she decides to do something extremely daring for her and go skinny dipping.
Oh, my.
Yes. And so...
well, we did in the movie have the scene of her, like, stripping down just to her, like, bra and underwear and jumping in the water. And then Kostos just like, my boob radar is flaring up.
Every
and
man
he just,
in
like,
the movie had boob radar.
Yeah, every man in the movie had boob radar. Mm-hmm. It's just like, a woman is taking off her shirt. And he just, like, magically appeared 30 seconds later.
Yes. And so actually, something a little similar happens where...
he stumbles on her skinny dipping.
Yes, yes. And so she freaks out and thinks he was stalking her, and she runs home. She puts the pants on inside out. That's a detail I always found funny. And so she goes back home, and she's freaking out and upset, and she doesn't explain to her grandparents what happened. She just says, Kostos is not a nice boy, and storms up to her room. And so her grandparents get the wrong idea and think that he assaulted her.
Okay.
And so they...
because she showed up in a state of half-undress saying he's a bad dude.
Yeah.
They assumed... okay.
Yes, they assume the worst. And so they go over to... where Kostos's grandparents are. And so that is where the grandpa fist fight happens, because Grandpa Kostos and Grandpa Lena get in a big argument.
I feel incredibly cheated that I didn't get a grandpa fist fight.
Yes.
This the version of the story they went with had more reason for a grandpa fist fight.
Yes.
And we still didn't get it.
Yes. So that happens, and after all of that drama occurs, you know, Lena is too freaked out to clarify to her grandparents that Kostos didn't actually hurt her, and so he just kind of avoids her. He's like, okay, and Kostos
she's not worth it. She's not worth it, bro.
Yeah, And so Lena just feels awkward and guilty about that, but she goes on her way, and then one day when she's going back to the Grove, she finds Kostos skinny dipping, and she freaks out and bolts. And later, she finds herself feeling really guilty because she assumed that he was stalking her.
And but he also had the same
guy.
Little secret Grove.
Yes, and then later, when she's talking to her grandma, they clear the air, and Lena explains that he didn't do what they thought he did, and grandma tells Lena the story of how Kostos is a sad orphan. And so Lena is feeling extra bad now, because not only did she falsely accuse this perfectly nice guy, but also he's an orphan, so that makes it worse.
See, I feel like that would have worked better in the movie than what they gave us.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you'd need to skirt around the nudity because they wanted to make it PG, but...
Yeah.
You could make that happen. The movie went from, like, this incredibly, like, earnest and believable and, like, heart-wrenching conversation with, like, Carmen and her dad on the phone that was, like, good, yeah, dramatic meets.
That might be the best scene in the movie.
I think I was the most invested in that scene in the movie. And then having that right side by side with, but the pants already gave me a miracle. They brought me to you.
So many things in this movie were punched up for Hollywood. And
this is four different movies all came together of varying quality.
Yeah.
And kind of infected each other a little bit. It was something special.
One other thing with mental health in this movie was how Bridget finally hits on this guy to get him to have sex with her, which is telling her about what her therapist said about her when she had to go to therapy after her mom committed suicide.
Yeah, that was just like, hey, here, you see what I got in my pocket here? It's a giant red flag. Let's fuck on it. This was like, oh, wow, okay.
It's funny because that's another thing that is established actually very early on in that character dynamic originally. Like when Bridget and Eric are on that run together and they get to talking about their families, and that's when she tells him.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's not a random thing she pulls out right before she puts the moves on him.
Yeah, yeah. So once again, pacing, who knows? I think the other thing I had to say the climax of the movie is also different.
It's hard to pinpoint because it was four separate stories.
Yeah, yeah, the thing is that the thing with Carmen attending her dad's wedding is that the way the movie does this is it's one of those things where you understand that, you know, it is a good idea for her to go and to have that closure with her dad, but the way it's executed is kind of horrible with, you know, her friends forcing her into it, and it's that whole thing that media does sometimes in fiction where you have a bunch of people telling a character to do the thing that's good for them, but it's executed in a way that just is actually, like, horrible. Like, don't force someone to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a book thing. And I just want to be clear for now that I'm talking about the book so much, not because I'm a purist. I actually hate judging things in a really purist way when it comes to adaptations. I want to be fair to things and to critique them appropriately. So when I'm talking about the book being better, it isn't that I'm mad that the movie changed it. It's that I'm mad that the way in which they changed it was not good.
Yes. So we don't have really anybody to swap into anything here, but Kiri did bring some reading material. You are the proud owner of the official Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants scrapbook and the Keep in Touch letters, notes, and more from the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants.
Yes. So the scrapbook is a behind-the-scenes book about the production of the movie, and it also has a character quiz, which we will get to in a moment. And the other thing is the Keep in Touch book is a set of, basically, it's the letters that the girls wrote to each other. It's a bunch of little in-universe, like, birthday cards and to-do lists, like, from their childhood or whatever. It's got a lot of cute stuff in it, funny stuff. There's actually some of Carmen's writing that didn't occur in the movie. So this is where Carmen's writing lives in this tie-in book. I just wanted to read this one particular thing written by Tibby in fourth grade. Just as a shout out to the Dragon Ball Z side of things that we haven't gotten to discuss here. So, a treatise on why I, Tabitha Rollins, should not be forced to play the piccolo. Firstly, let me make it clear when I realize that this is an unorthodox request. But we have been told to stand up for our rights here at school, and if I am forced to play the piccolo, my rights will have been violated. Fourth grade is a time of exploration. It is a time of learning, a time of wonder, and a time of enjoying what is left of childhood. It is not a time of practicing an instrument that will have no viable purpose as a contributing adult in our society. I implore you, respect my rights as a citizen of this community, and do not make me a piccolo player against my will. A piccolo player coerced to play the piccolo cannot make music of the heart. Any further questions can be addressed to my attorneys, Mr. and Mrs. Rollins. Sincerely, Tabitha Tippy Rollins.
So, I think that's just, that's a treatise on not being forced to be a piccolo player in Dragon Ball FighterZ.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing that. Piccolo, yeah. Piccolo makes no contributions in your adult life. Well, I don't think that's entirely true. Mm-hmm. Piccolo's still got some contributions left in him this season, but that does eventually become true.
Yeah.
So, what is the other thing? Because we can't really do a swap this week because we don't have two things to swap, but we do...
You said there's a character quiz.
Yes. You can find out which pants girl are you.
I've always wanted to know which pants girl I was.
Okay, so get your pencils ready.
I got it.
One, if you had to pick one of the following as your life's motto, which would you choose?
Oh, geez.
Oh, no.
A, always look on the bright side. B, live and let live. C, bonsai. D, life sucks, then you die.
Wait, what's the difference between always look on the bright side and bonsai?
You do something about it.
I interpreted bonsai more as, like, leaping into, like, yeah, new situations, whereas look on the bright side is more about optimism.
Let's go for optimism for me. That's A.
Yes.
See, all these answers are terrible.
Oh, no, they're all terrible. Just pick the least terrible one.
I guess live and let live.
Okay.
B.
B.
Yeah.
Two. Which of the following animals do you identify with the most?
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
A. A dog. B. A cat. C. A cheetah. D. A platypus.
D. I don't want to be a dog, I'm not a cat, and I'm definitely not a cheetah. Also, that's two cats. D. Just
cause. I guess a cat.
Three. What's your favorite kind of pants? A. Anything cute, colorful, and sort of slimming is cool by me. B. No pants, thanks. I prefer skirts and dresses. C. Jogging pants, shorts, khakis, jeans, whatever doesn't get in my way. D. Who cares? Pants are pants. There are more important things to think about in the world.
C.
See, I don't like pants, but I also don't like skirts or dresses. Yeah. But I guess I'm also going to go with B on principle, because pants suck.
4. Which of the following features is most important to you in a significant other? A. Smarts, kindness, a great sense of humor, I want it all. B. Understanding, without that, what's the point? C. Anyone I hang with has got to know how to have fun. D.
If you want to be my lover, you have to get with my friends. Okay, keep going.
D. Honesty. Blunt, tactful, or somewhere in between. Just tell me the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but.
I guess A.
A?
Yeah, I'm going to go with A as well.
Okay.
5. How do you usually approach a new experience? A. I wouldn't say I like change, but I take it in stride. Or at least I try. B. Avoidance, avoidance, avoidance. C. Straight on, eyes wide open, and full steam ahead. D. As a thrilling new opportunity for sarcasm. Tibby, you fucking edgelord.
Sorry, what were A and B again? A.
6. What's your favorite part of the school day? Homeroom or between classes when I get to catch up with my friends? B. Art or music class where I can express myself? C. Gym class, I definitely prefer basketball to books. D. Lunch. What better place to observe the rainbow of human dorkitude in all its glory?
God damn it, Tibby.
Edgelord!
None of those were English.
Yeah, none of those were English.
I love Tibby so much, I want to shove her into a locker.
Okay.
7. How are you with foreign languages? I just want to state that I object to this question because it has nothing to do with personality, but anyway. A. I am bilingual or close to it. B. I do my best, but I'm nowhere near fluent. C. The only language I care about is universal. Body language. D.
Is it fluent in sarcasm? Is D fluent in sarcasm? Kiri, tell me the truth.
Not quite, but D. I speak geek and dork fluently and am well on my way to learning loser.
Ah, that's even worse.
That's worse.
B? Yeah, B.
Which of the following attitudes best matches your own? A. I am who I am. Take me or leave me, but I hope you'll decide to take me, please.
That's needy.
B. Look before you leap. C. Leap before you look. D. Live free or die.
What?
God damn it, Tibby.
What?
What?
I'm gonna go with A just because that'll give me an even split.
We're both half A and half B.
Are we really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because this quiz was stupid.
Well, you at least had one C and one D.
I did.
But
we both had equal amounts of A and B.
Okay, so that means that you are both half Carmen and half Lena.
That sounds about right.
You want to be everybody's friend, but you're not quite sure you dare. Sensitive and emotional.
Dare.
Sensitive and emotional. You're slow to trust, but loyal once you do.
That's not right at all.
No, that's completely inaccurate.
It's almost like this quiz wasn't well written.
I don't know. I like the idea that the quiz, much like the pants, has magic where it'll determine your compatibility with others. And so the fact that we both got the same means that, you know, we're a good match, and so it's good that we're married.
Yeah.
You also got the same answer on the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. What character are you, quiz?
Wow.
Wow. Well, folks, with that, I think that was our Gilmore Ball Z bonus episode.
That's all I have in me.
That is all Paige has left in her. So, if you enjoyed this and want to see more episodes like it, go ahead and check out the link in the description to the Gohan and Rory Book Club Fund. From there, you can see what our current stretch goals are and what new and exciting bonus content you can unlock by donating. And, as always, all of the money for that goes to a charity called Room to Read, which is providing educational equality for children in developing countries. Kira, you look like you want to say something.
If you donate more, I'll probably get to make them watch the second Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants movie.
That is entirely possible.
Yes.
If you enjoy our suffering. And, as always, we are matching every donation at least up until the first $500. So whatever you give, you can count it as doubled. And so with that, I believe that's Gilmore Ball Z. So we'll see you next Saturday for our regularly scheduled programming. And thank you all for listening.